welcome. Thanks for joining me for this week's Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and ultimately successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that delightful instant when you can jump up and down and shout, "Yes, I'm in." And not only in, but in at the best program for you. Now, the last several weeks, we have focused on MBA programs or different flavors of management education from around the world. But this week, I would like to change gears and return to med school and healthcare admissions. In doing so, I would also like to introduce our special guest, who happens to be the former chair of the University of Arizona College of Medicine Admissions Committee and Accepted's newest consultant. Although I don't have a specific question from the audience that I'm going to address today, and we'll get back to our guests in just a second, I do want to remind you that you can pose questions that I or our guests will address during the podcast by simply leaving a message for me at info.accepted.com/76. You can scroll down to the widget with a mic to leave an audio message in which you can ask your question. Just speak using your computer mic or your phone. You can also send me questions via email at questions@accepted.com. If your question is chosen, I'll ask and answer it on the show. Oh, and FYI, if you just want to ask your question in a comment on the blog, please feel free to do that too. We're developing a wonderfully collaborative, supportive, and thoughtful community on Accepted, so feel free to comment there. I'm very excited to introduce Dr. Herman Gordon, our guest, who likes to be called Flash, as in Flash Gordon. I guess he's a hero. If you can't be a hero in the cartoons, you might as well be a hero in the admissions world. First, a little background. Dr. Gordon earned his AB at Harvard College and his PhD at Caltech. He's an associate professor of cellular and molecular medicine at the University of Arizona's College of Medicine and has been there since 1991. In recent years, in addition to his passion for admissions and cellular biology, he has immersed himself in teaching people how to think and actually developed a teaching system, an app to encourage development, and here I'm quoting, of critical thinking, communication, collaboration, and creativity in hybrid learning environments. I guess we're going to have to learn about what that means a little later in the podcast. We'll mine Dr. Gordon's knowledge of medical school admissions, but also learn about vital critical thinking skills and how to nurture them. Flash, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Hi, Linda. Glad to be here.
Okay. How did you get into medical school admissions?
I was choosing amongst various service committees to be on, and I wanted something that would be meaningful, that where there was a tangible product and you were doing good for the world. And so I got onto the admissions committee, and once I was there, I really discovered a passion for it. You are changing the world because you're deciding on who's going to be the future doctors. And it's a lot of work, and I think everybody who's involved in admissions has to be dedicated because of all the work that's involved. But it's also incredibly rewarding.
Right. I guess you're shaping the classes that you're going to be teaching, right?
That's right.
You're creating the classes you're going to be teaching.
That's right. So I get to pick the students that I want to teach.
That's true. Now, when you reviewed or evaluated a medical school application, what were you looking for?
We're looking for the individual. So someone who stands out, who is unique, who can give something to the profession, to their patients, to the world, because of who they are. If everybody's the same, then it doesn't matter who we pick. But if there are people who have, passions for service or there's something that drives them, that makes them valuable, both to themselves and to the people they interact with and to the world. So that's what we're looking for. It's not anything that you can put into a formula. Clearly, there are minimum standards that have to be met. But after that, there are a lot of choices, and the kinds of people we want are unique people. They've got something to offer to the world. And when they're in med school, it turns out they offer it to each other as classmates. So by using the standard of uniqueness, we create a system which moves forward with that unique individual. They're always contributing. There's always something that they can give to the other people around them.
I wonder, you know, obviously we're all unique. Every human being walking on the planet is unique in some way or another. Why is it such a struggle to for that uniqueness to come through in the applications?
I think some people don't trust the, you know, the story that they can tell for themselves. And so they try to tell some sort of standardized story. And from the admissions perspective, that's not what we want to hear. We don't want cookie cutters. We don't want, you know, the wonks who just, you know, did everything that they were supposed to do and checked off the boxes for their application. We want people who are driven and who are doing it because they want to do it. And we, you know, there may be a lot of people out there who are doing that, but we don't see it because it's not coming through in their application.
Right, right.
So I think part of this, part of it is that that story has to get out to the applicants that they need to be themselves. That's probably the single biggest advice I give to people who ask me about applying to med school is, you know, be prepared, be yourself, and go for it.
Right. I'm getting two kinds of calls these days from medical school applicants. The first one starts something like, I've applied, I'm not getting interviews, I think I need to prepare for a reapplication. What should I be doing? And the second one is kind of bright out of bushy-tailed. The first one's a little bit beaten down. The second one is, I'm planning to apply for the first time this summer. What should I be doing? How would you help the first person who usually is a little discouraged, a little careworn, doubtful of their path? I've applied. I'm not getting interviews. I think I need to prepare for reapplication. What should I be doing? What would you tell that person?
Well, they need to figure out why it is that they're not getting interviews. Mm-hmm. Certainly, the interview is the biggest hurdle to getting into medical school. So at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, it's a 1 out of 7 cut between those who have made it through the secondary applications and those who get interviews. So that, you know, that first cut is partially based on metrics. It depends on the school. It can be very much based on the secondary application. That can be an important tool for getting to the interview stage, especially if the school has mission-based metrics. So they're looking for, does this applicant satisfy the particular missions that we're looking to develop.
Now, as a mission, is the mission usually defined on the school's website?
Yes, it better be.
That's what I was thinking, right?
Yeah, so, you know, LCME is pretty strict about how medical school admissions works. They want everything above board. And, you know, if you, in order to get your certification in med school, really has to comply with all of that. So that means there has to be a website that has on it the criteria that the med school uses. Now, what are the minimum criteria to get in? If there are mission-based criteria, then those need to be out there too.
Right, right.
So if the student's not getting interviews, so presumably, you know, they've done all the right things, they need to find out why they're not getting the interviews. So is it that they have not met the minimum criteria? So the biggest help they can get in figuring this out is to call up the admissions office of the med schools to which they most want to get in. And just ask. The admissions office staff are very knowledgeable, very helpful. They have access to the AMCAS files. They have access to all of the decision-making that has happened so far. So they can tell the applicant, you know, was there something that killed this deal? Maybe the MCAT was insufficient.
Mm-hmm.
They can tell the applicant, and then the applicant knows, well, now I've got to go, you know, really bone up from my next round of MCATs. And I've had students who've been in that situation who I've advised. The other, I think, so The other thing that the applicant should be thinking about is, well, suppose they have met all of these minimums, and the application should be strong. Well, why aren't they making it through? And there, I think, it's all about the personal statement and what goes into the secondary application. So this is where the applicant really explains who they are and what they're going to do as a physician. You know, why is it important for them to be admitted to med school so that they can go on and give to the world whatever it is that they have to give? That has to be clear. I think a lot of applicants just get mired into, you know, looking like all the other applicants.
Yeah.
And that's not going to cut it unless they've got, like, super strong metrics.
Right. Well, isn't there somewhat of a catch-22 here? Because on one hand, they need to somehow describe their passion for medicine or what they're going to contribute to medicine or their fitness simply for medicine, let's say the primary application.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the secondary application, obviously you have to respond to the specific question, but the secondary application is much more about fit with a specific school. So on one hand, they are supposed to be addressing the same question. On the other hand, they're supposed to be unique individuals. So is that perhaps where the struggle for individuality, is that the genesis of that struggle?
Oh, I see. So if they're...
They're all writing about the same topic. Not really, they're writing about themselves, so that would be the point of difference. But if the point of the primary essay is to show fitness for medicine, and the point of the secondary essay, in most cases, it can differ slightly, but in most cases, is to show fitness with a particular school and its mission or its approach to medical education. And at the same time, they're supposed to be showing a lot of individuality while doing that. Again, I see somewhat of a conundrum or tension to that situation.
Right. Well, that individuality has to fit with what the particular med school is looking for, too.
Right.
That's part of the work for the applicant is to go out and look for those med schools for which they'll be a good match.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, at the University of Arizona, a lot of the applicants are interested in the Commitment to Underserved Population program, which is very strong there and has a national reputation. And so those kinds of students will apply, and those will also be the kinds of students who will rise through the process and be more likely to be accepted. So there is a bit of that. But, you know, you can't not be yourself.
Oh, so completely agree.
Suppose you don't want to do that kind of program. You've got an interest in something else. Maybe you want to do radiology, and, you know, you just love physics and everything that goes into radiology. Well, then you need to look for programs that will value that.
Right.
And, it may be that the school in your home state has particular missions which don't really match up with your personal missions. Then you're just going to have to...
Other than paying in-state tuition.
Right.
All right. So how would you advise the second applicant I mentioned? I'm planning to apply for the first time. Again, this applicant is bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Maybe he or she has taken the MCAT already. Maybe not, but she is convinced she's going to get a high score. Her grades are good, she thinks. How would you advise this person?
Okay. So presumably they've got good academic metrics. Especially these days, they need to be able to explain why medicine is the career for them. And that needs to be demonstrable. So not just physician shadowing, but they had to have made some sort of serious commitment to trying medicine out. So they really know what it is that they're getting into. And hopefully they've got a letter of reference that supports that meaningful medically related experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's key on top of the academics.
Right. Okay. So you would basically advise them to make sure that they have some clinical exposure to back up claims of,
yes,
of passion for medicine.
Yes.
Absolutely.
You know, a lot of my colleagues who are practicing physicians today didn't have that when they applied to med school. But times have changed. You do need that today.
Yes. I also think it's not just a matter of needing it for admissions. You need it to know that it's the right thing for you. I mean, medical school,
yes,
is a major commitment.
Yes.
And
if you're going into it for money,
yeah,
you're going to learn.
Yeah. Well,
that
must. Yeah, right.
That money's going to come at quite a price.
But I would say even if you're going into it for the right reasons, you know,
right,
the motivations, you have to know that you're going to be happy in that environment doing that kind of work.
Yeah. And certainly, you know, there are plenty of students who love that.
Right.
They love everything about medicine. Those are the ones who should be there. So.
Right. Now, if someone has not yet turned in their MCAS application, we are having our conversation here. It's October 6th. MCAS is officially still open, but, of course, it's been open since June 1. Secondaries have been going out since July. Interviews are ongoing as of now. Should the person who still hasn't submitted the MCAS with the hopes of matriculating in 2015, would you advise them to wait at this point? Or, depending on their individual circumstances, perhaps, yes, go ahead. There's still spots.
Yeah, what are they going to lose?
Well,
I think there's a common misconception that if you apply to med school and you get rejected, that it's over.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, an awful lot of students who are accepted this year were rejected in previous years.
Right.
We've had students even applying, you know, five times. It's on their fifth time that they finally get in.
Wow.
And so there are two issues here. So one is just realizing that med school is different than college. You know, you've got time, you go back and you improve your application, you improve your preparation, and then your chances are much better the next year. Now the second issue here is, well, is there something that looks bad applying at the 11th hour?
Uh-huh.
There are some people on admissions committees who do feel that that's a sign of a student who, you know, is lazy, unprepared, blah, blah, blah. Thankfully, those people are in the minority, and most med schools have so-called rolling admissions. So as the applications come in, the very best ones get accepted right away because they want to accept those students before another school does.
Sure.
In hopes that the student will accept back.
Right.
And then and, you know, those applications that come in at the 11th hour, well, they still come in. There's still slots open, and they get considered along with everybody else. And as far as the admissions committee is concerned, they got an application, and they judge it. You know,
okay.
Somebody we want here. So,
okay.
So I would definitely encourage everyone to get their application in. No matter how late it is, you know, it's 5 minutes before the deadline. If you can get it in, get it in. Otherwise,
it's
a whole nother year.
That's true.
And even if you get rejected, you're going to learn stuff from that experience that will help you to write a better application for the coming year. And you would not have had access to that information had you not put in your application at the 11th hour.
Good point. Now let's shift focus a little bit and just talk about the University of Arizona College of Medicine. And you mentioned that the program it has for underserved populations. What about it is distinctive? What makes it special or unique? Since we're talking about uniqueness
today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there are certain programs like that. So there's a real commitment to underserved populations. You know, we're in the Southwest, so there are a lot of Native American reservations in Arizona and in the general area. And so that's actually part of the mission of the U of A College of Medicine is to serve the Native Americans that are in the surrounding area. So those are more mission-based, but I think just for students in general, independent of those opportunities and missions, what really sets the Med School apart is the student-centered focus of the whole educational system. So a good third of the education is small group education. And so this is typically 8-9 students in a group. And it comes in various different formats. So one is the doctor-patient program, which the University of Arizona was one of the first to implement. So beginning in the first week of medical school, you and, say, 6 other students are working with your physician mentor, and you're going out and you're seeing patients, and you're learning, sort of in an apprentice mode, how medicine works. And that, I think that that's a very important thing. It helps define your professional identity, but it's also a great learning experience. I'm part of the case-based instruction program, which is very innovative at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. So we use cases to teach not content, but clinical reasoning. And the cases, there's a developmental progression, but the cases are always very challenging, no matter what level the students are at. And what we found is that by raising the challenge, that the students rise to that challenge, and they really get inspired. It's like, oh, this was hard, and I learned this about myself, that I really need to think first before I jump into the problem, or just trust whatever it is I read on up to date. And so this, these cases are done in the present. Well, first of all, they're done online, and then the students can see each other's work. And so coming into the face-to-face session, typically on Fridays, everybody knows that everybody else has been thinking, but now there's still more that has to be resolved. And so everybody has to go through and justify, why they're thinking about different diagnoses. So maybe there are 3 different diagnoses that people have come up with. Well, well, let's go through all the evidence and figure out what works for and against each of these diagnoses. And then, the faculty facilitator is there asking probing questions. What do you think about, the patient's not having a fever? How does that affect your diagnoses? And so it's very challenging, and really it does take the first 2 years in med school to really develop the skills of being able to, reason your way through a case. We call it a flight simulator.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to die.
Right, right.
Once you get out on third, in your third year, you're doing this for real, with real people. Yeah. I think that that's a really exciting component of the program. And so very much we depend on the quality of our students, because we set it up so that students learn from each other. They learn the skills from each other. The faculty provide the content and the guidance as they go through med school. And, I think our students are very happy. They enjoy their experience. And, from learning theory, it's clear that you learn when you're having fun.
Sure.
Well, it may be a lot of work, but it's fun, and, you're moving forward.
So. I think how much little children learn. They do most of it by having fun.
Yes. And I think that that's kind of what we're modeling is, almost a playful, engaging experience, so that it's just fun to learn. It's just, it's what you want to do.
Yeah.
Now, so with our cases, during the week, the students are all in the hallways and talking to faculty, well, what did you think about this? And, so it's really fun to watch.
I can imagine also that it's just tremendously advantageous when they get to the third year in the clinical rounds to have had both the mentoring in the prior 2 years and as well as well as the whole case-based approach also.
Yes, and that's what we're hearing both from the faculty in the third and fourth years, as well as the students in the third and fourth years, you know, that they really appreciate how well they were prepared for the experience to come.
Right. Now, let's go to a different topic now. What distinguishes a good MD application from a good MD-PhD application, a medical scientist from opposed to the clinical doctor?
I suspect that this varies a lot between med schools. So clearly, the MD-PhD application, you know, the ultimate application would be both a strong MD application and a strong PhD application. So I've also served on PhD admissions committees. And it is quite different what you're looking for. MD application, you know, they need people who are going to be able to interact socially with other people. And in the PhD world, that's not a requirement. When you're considering an MD-PhD application, are you willing to give up some of your requirements on either side? In the best cases, no. You really want somebody who can be a clinician and who also has shown that they love science and are good at doing science. I don't know that I've answered your question, though.
I think you have. I think you've answered it well, actually. Now, part of the University of Arizona's evaluation process, as at most medical schools, and the critical element really is the interview. But the University of Arizona has the MMI interview. And can you, first of all, I guess, give a brief description of what is the MMI at the University of Arizona, and then what makes for a great MMI interview, or interviews, I should say?
Okay, so the MMI comes out of McMaster. It addresses, what it is multiple mini interviews. So basically you have typically 6 to 8 stations, and the student goes from station to station. It's like about 10 minutes between station. And at the station there is one interviewer who does the same interview with every student every 10 minutes. The idea is that one interview of an applicant for half an hour or an hour is very biased by that particular interviewer. And from the admissions committee standpoint, we're looking at some of these interviews and we're wondering, well, how much of this is the interviewer and how much is the interviewee? And what the MMI does is it trains an interviewer in a particular question or a particular scenario and make sure that they're really good at it, and then they do it over and over in a uniform way with all of the applicants. So that when the feedback from that interviewer gets back to the admissions committee, the admissions committee knows what to do with it. They know what this means and that they can trust it. And in addition, since the student has gone to multiple mini interviews, say 6 or more, you then get different perspectives on the student that you would probably not get from a single interviewer. So from the admissions committee standpoint, we had 3 years of developing the MMIs while I was on the committee. And frankly, the first 2 years were a little bit rough, and that corresponds to the experience of other schools. But the last year that I was on, I thought that the multiple mini interviews really worked to their full potential. They scaled the, they sort of standardized the stations so that you can compare between interviewers. And then they put all of the results together into a numerical score. But the biggest change in that third year from the admissions committee standpoint was that we asked the interviewers to provide three sentences on each of their interviewees. And those were more meaningful than anything.
Right.
And it really gave us insight into, who these applicants really were. A lot of times, they're trying too hard in their personal essay or whatever. But when you see consistent character attributes across all the many interviews, then that person really comes through. And so then you also asked for advice on how to prepare for the multiple mini interviews. Definitely, you should practice with friends so that you understand the format, you're comfortable with it. Sometimes the questions are out there. You can go find on websites a lot of the questions that are used in multiple mini interviews. There will always be a question about why do you want to be a doctor? And the answers on that one are usually pretty standard, but sometimes you come up with something that's really interesting and that really stands out in the application. The other kind of interview is a scenario where there's an actor who's paid to play the role of a patient, and you're given 1 minute before actually walking into the room to read what the scenario is and be prepared to respond to whatever the actor gives you. And then the interviewer actually observes your interaction with the actor. So that's good to have some practice with. If you're not comfortable at acting, well, it's going to behoove you to do a little bit of practice so you are comfortable with that kind of situation. Now, unfortunately, the MMIs do favor outgoing personalities.
Right.
And that's not necessarily fair because not all great physicians have outgoing personalities. And we want to really value each person for who they are. So there's still some work ahead, I think, both at the University of Arizona and other schools who are using the multiple mini interview to try to elicit real sort of fundamental character qualities that don't require an outgoing personality.
That's great. I think one thing
Go
ahead.
Sorry, there's one more thing. In addition to just preparing with the format so that you know what's coming, the other really big piece of advice is to be yourself. Don't memorize.
Don't have
answers. We will see that. There will be a statement to the admissions committee, this felt like a canned answer, it was overprepared. And then, it's a write-off. We don't know. We don't get very much out of that interview.
All right, yeah. We had Sydney Foote, another executive consultant, gave a webinar last week on medical school interviews, not the MMI. We're actually having a webinar on MMI interviews on October 28th. So, and I'll include a link in the show notes to that so that anybody can, if you listen to this before October 28th, you can register for the webinar if you're interested. And if you listen to this after October 28th, you can view the recording. But what I was going to say was Sid opened the webinar with a little clip. I think it was from ER, and it was like a bunch of interviews, necessarily three people looking bored as can be. And the question was, why do you want to be a doctor? And the applicants, one after the other, sometimes very seriously, sometimes very cheerfully, sometimes, with a good deal of feeling, sometimes a little bit more deadpan. I want to help people. I want to help people. I want to help.
Right.
And the clip was hysterical. I mean, it was. Whoever put it together clearly knows what they were doing, but it was very funny. And I would think that it's the opposite of course, showing individuality. Though there was a certain individuality that came through in a caricatured kind of way in this little clip.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, Yeah. And one of the things that Sid said was, you know, think about how you're going to want to respond to various answers and do some practice so that you're comfortable with whatever format you're going to be dealing with, but don't memorize.
Right.
Right. Right. That was not. Now, let's again shift gears for a minute. Can you tell us a bit about your app and your work to teach critical thinking skills?
Yeah. Oh, sure. So I'm a neuroscientist by training, and I'm really interested in how synapses function at the molecular and the cellular level. And I had been teaching a team teaching a graduate course in cell biology. And I was getting increasingly frustrated because we would give these exam questions that required a lot of thought. You know, it's like, well, take the information that you've learned and put it together and, you know, create new things, create experiments. And we were having a really hard time getting the students to respond to that. And so I decided that I needed to teach problem solving in and of itself, with a particular view towards grad students, but also to undergraduate students. And so I picked up a course that had been left dormant by the death of Art Winfrey, who was a colleague of mine here. And it was a course that was devoted strictly to problem solving, and it used puzzles as a tool so that students from all domains on campus could come together and they would be on an equal playing field. But by encouraging all these students to come together, we could then focus on the what was in common in their problem solving, and we could also use the differences in the backgrounds of all these students to make students aware of the diversity of approaches to problem solving. And so I started teaching this. I tried to recreate the course based on student notes, and I learned a lot along the way. One of the things I learned was that students need organization, that the an organized way of solving problems is very effective, and that it's not something I can expect the students to learn. It's something that I, as a teacher, need to provide and work with students so that they learn the value of that structured approach. So the structured approach to problem solving actually goes back to a mathematician by the name of George Polya at Stanford, created this after World War II. And he wrote a book called How to Solve It. And the basic structure goes something like, define the problem. What is it that you're trying to solve? Then brainstorm about it. Formulate a strategy of how you're going to move forward. Then actually attempt to solve the problem. And when you're all done, reflect on what happened. You know, what worked, what didn't work. And it turns out that this structured approach to problem solving is now across many fields. We had a student come to our College of Medicine who had served in Afghanistan, and he saw this five-step approach to problem solving, and he said, "This is right out of the Army manual." So a lot of different fields have picked this up as a valuable thing to teach. So the structured problem solving is an important part of it. Another part is that, these days we use computers. We have a virtual life as well as our live life. And the we've set up our case-based instruction so that we give our cases virtually online, and the students work through this five-step process, although the steps have different names for medical cases. And after they've made their entries at each of the steps, they then get to see what their colleagues in the group have created, and then they're free to go back and revise anything that they've been thinking. And what this does is it forces a commitment. Each person takes ownership of the problem because they have to create their thoughts before they can go look at anybody else's thoughts. But it also creates the value for the diversity of thinking. And so this, you know, we don't really have to encourage them to go look at each other's stuff. You know, they see the value in it and then use it to revise their own thinking. And frequently, you know, it shows up in the reflections at the end of the case. It's like, well, you know, Joseph had this really good way of approaching this problem. You know, he laid it out on a timeline, and I think that that really worked. And, you know, next time I see a problem like this, I'm going to try that too. So, you know, that's what it's all about. It's you know, creating what we call a hybrid learning environment. So there's the online portion as well as the face-to-face portion. And I think that's where modern education is at. It's not one or the other.
Right.
It's both working together.
I mean, I think that's where we're at, you know, as a society. We live in both online and, you know, virtual and real worlds. We interact with people virtually and face-to-face, both. Sometimes I think we're forgetting about the face-to-face a little bit too much, but that's a different question.
Well, there's a real advantage to the online component in that it prepares a group to meet together.
Mm-hmm.
So now they come together. You know, typically, you know, in the old days of case-based instruction, we'd have two students who would dominate the conversation, and there'd be two students who you never heard a peep out of. And the other students were sort of in between.
Right.
So you never knew if the quiet students had actually done the work or if they had any good thoughts and stuff. And now that you can see it in their online entries, you can value that. And you can also use it to bring them into the conversation. So what I find using this approach is that the conversations are very open. Everybody's engaged in it. Everybody's contributing. It's much more dynamic and I think successful than the old format had been.
Right. It makes sense. Do you have any tips for people who wanted to nurture their own critical thinking skills? I want to improve
reflection.
My critical thinking. Yes.
Okay, so reflection, as we know from the education literature, is the most important part of education. So reflection is, you know, just thinking about what you've done, what you want to do, how you want to improve. That process can change you, can cause you to be permanently improved for the rest of your life in ways that other kinds of education can't have an effect. You know, there's so much content that comes through medicine. It's very typical to ask a student about something that they learned 2 weeks ago, and they can't even remember that they ever learned it. It's just the content goes in.
So by reflection,
it gets dumped on the test, and then it's gone.
Yeah.
But those things that they've reflected about, you know, that they, you know, now they have new thinking strategies. Well, those are part of them. That's just who they are.
Right. So when you talk about reflection, you're not talking about just review, which frequently just means memorization. You're talking about doing some thinking about it, some analyzing.
Right. Yeah. What did I do wrong? What could I have done better? Yeah, admitting to yourself.
Okay. Let's see. You know, I'm going to ask you. I have more questions here, but I'm going to control myself. Any last minute thoughts for aspiring doctors? Any last minute pieces of advice?
In terms of their applications. I just
want
to hit
whatever you want. Applications would be a good way.
Oh, in terms of preparing themselves, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, definitely. You know, so early on, we touched on this before. I think it's really important to make sure that this is what you want to do. You know, it's not just watching somebody else do it. You need to do it. A really great job is as an ER scribe. So you get paid to do this. And as a result, people put expectations on you to do a good job.
You have responsibility.
And you are Yeah, you are right there. You know, you're watching the whole thing. Every now and then, they'll be shorthanded, and they'll call you in. The doctors very frequently, you know, if they find a good scribe, will share their thought processes with the scribe. It can be an incredibly valuable learning experience. So you want to find something like that so that you are being a doc, you know, or you're coming close to it. Other people find a similar experience working abroad on medical missions. So I would encourage people who can pursue those opportunities to pursue them too. I think they're really valuable experiences. You know, they'll make you know what's inside of you that you want to develop in becoming a physician.
Those are great suggestions. Listener, just so you should know, I interviewed last December Catherine Gregg, who is the regional manager of clinical information managers for Emergency Medical Associates. She is a scribe, and the podcast is entitled A Window into the World and Life of Medical Scribes. It is incredibly valuable information. Now, Flash, I'm just wondering, would you, I mean, not that this is bad in any way, but would you encourage that applicants, let's say they shadowed a physician, now that gives them a window into the life of a doctor, but would you encourage them to do something more hands-on? I mean, both of the suggestions you made, definitely more hands-on than shadowing.
Yeah, if possible. Typically, you know, so shadowing experiences that are just sort of one time, maybe a day shadowing
right.
a doctor,
right.
You know, they're okay, but they don't really add up to the kind of experience I'm talking about where you get to know yourself better and you really develop that fundamental motivation. Sometimes you can have an ongoing sort of shadow experience with a doctor that can develop into something more hands-on. I know that these positions are difficult to find, especially these days because of liability issues. Way back when, I used to work in a free clinic in California, and, you know,
right.
I would take the patient histories and order tests. And
oh, my goodness.
But you're not allowed to do that anymore.
I don't think so. talking about volunteer work, I had many years ago, one of our children was ill, and he was going to regularly to a certain clinic, and they had a playroom set up for the kids, and at the time it was videos. This was in the mid to late 90s. And so there was this one, obviously, college student, pre-med, who was quote-unquote volunteering in the playroom or in the clinic. And it was pathetic. This guy was just sitting there watching the kiddie videos, and he was quote-unquote volunteering. And I could see from the staff that they were very unimpressed with him. He was not going to get a recommendation. He wasn't learning anything, that's for sure. I mean, you've probably seen the kiddie videos when he was younger. And I remember I didn't do it, but all I wanted to do was go over to him, shake him by the shoulders, you know, grab him by the shoulders and shake him and say, "What are you doing? You're wasting your time."
Right.
But
right.
Yeah, that.
And you're wasting your opportunity. You
absolutely.
Know? These are sick kids, and it may look like it's just a playroom. But there are real opportunities to help people there.
Oh, absolutely. And he was doing nothing. I think eventually somebody gave him something, you know, some specimen to take to a lab. And that was his big contribution for the day. But if he had been more forthcoming, they would have been showing him stuff. He could perhaps have watched procedures. I mean, there were incredible things going on there. But he mm-hmm. was choosing to watch kiddie videos. He was not being reflective, that's for sure. Right. In any case, Flash, thank you so much for joining me for today's podcast. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I think we've really covered a lot. Listener, if you would like to learn more about Flash and his work, you can find the link to his bio in the show notes at info.excipit.com/76. And if you are an applicant to medical school residency programs or MD-PhD programs, you can have his assistance with your medical school application. For details, please see his bio page. Listener, thank you, too, for joining me. Again, I've linked to several resources mentioned today in the show notes, so visit info.excipit.com/76, just the number 76, and you'll have access to these resources. Finally, please share your feedback. 5-star reviews on iTunes are particularly welcome. You can leave any kind of feedback on iTunes, the blog, or by emailing linda@accepted.com. Oh, and if you like this show, subscribe, and you'll get lots more shows just like it. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted. I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.